You have to show up. You have to commit to showing up, and that's it. You know, you don't have to commit to anything working or anything coming true or success in whatever way we've been taught to think of success. You just have to show up to your studio.
This is Studio Confessions, the art podcast. I am your host, Luis Martin, the art engineer. Listen in for conversations with artists and culture makers as we talk about their creative practice and what moves them. Let me share my wax poetic monologues and how to activate your creativity to live an inspired and more beautiful life. That's right, I said beautiful. Welcome to the studio. I'm glad you're here. Hola, Francisco. ¿Qué tal? How are you?
Hi, Luis. Good. Thank you. Thank you for having me.
I'm so excited to sit here and speak with you. So you are in New York. I you know, ever since COVID happened, I've been like using Skype. So it's like, like my reach has expanded. So when I get to speak to a New Yorker, it's like, oh, right, they're artists in New York. Where in New York are you?
Yeah, but exactly. I was going to say it probably still feels like we're super far away from each other because I'm in northern Manhattan.
And I'm...
I live in
Williamsburg somewhere, like,
yeah, so it's still, we're still really, really far away despite being in the same city, you know what I mean?
Yeah, totally. Yeah. And during this whole COVID, it feels even bigger, you know what I mean? So your studio is in the South Bronx?
Yes.
How long have you had your studio there?
I've been there, I think like 2 years, a little bit more than 2 years, I want to say. I think. No, wait. I don't remember, but it's or something around that time. Yeah,
that's awesome. Yeah. What's that been like?
Yeah, it's life changing.
Yeah,
it's a huge game changer for me. Yeah, I mean, for the longest time, I had my studio at home, and I've had different setups. I've moved around a lot for a couple of years, and each apartment, each setup was a different situation. So nothing was really quite stable, and I just couldn't work big. I couldn't. Yeah. It was extremely limiting. I mean, let me tell you, I think having a studio at home is like a huge privilege. And it's incredibly important, I think, to have anything, any kind of setup, even if you just have a little desk space. That's all you really need. But I got to the point where I outgrew years and years and years of doing that. And so I finally was able to rent my first studio in New York City.
Oh, wow.
Prior to that, I've had studios in other places, but through residencies or other programs. And this was my first sort of like my own studio. So, I mean, I share it, but still it's incredible. It's been a huge game changer for me.
You're right. It really is a game changer, because it becomes like a job, right? Like you set your hours, and while you do the same thing when you have a studio at home, but there is something very official about it. Like you have to go during the rain, during the heat, you have, like we were speaking about earlier, you have to budget in transportation. Do you want to get a bike or not? You know?
Right.
But it also,
absolutely.
But it also, you become part of a community, right? Because if your studio is somewhere else, then you become part of that culture. What has that been like? Have you even going to like the local cafe, right? That becomes a thing. Mm-hmm. What does your community look like?
It's awesome. I mean, the cool thing is that I have a mixed building. So there's businesses in my building, but it's a warehouse type of thing. Like it used to be a factory, I'm sure, at some point. And it's right by the water. So it's in this really weird industrial sector. There's a ton of trucks. There's not a lot of places to like go and waste time, which is good.
Mm-hmm.
When I'm there, I'm in my studio. And if I walk around, I'm going to get food. Or I am, sometimes I will go get a beer at the Bronx Brewery, which is not far away. So that's like more summertime last year. But my building has a lot of artists in it, on my floor and then the floor above me. Everything below are businesses, so I don't really interact much with those folks. Though, you know, we cross paths and it's a ton of Latinos, so that's really nice. But the artists in my building are from the people that I've met. Amazing. They're really cool. Really, really cool people. Don't socialize a lot with them because, again, when I'm in my studio, when I go, it's like I'm really just locked myself away in my studio. But I've been able to meet a lot of really interesting people and get connected to a bigger community that I didn't have access to before. And even like meeting folks who have then become collectors that live in the neighborhood. So I've been like literally walk my painting over, you know, and deliver it. And it's like, hey neighbor, you know,
I love that.
That's super cool. Yeah.
Yeah. I have my studio at home and I have been, I'm like so happy because I can really produce and not, you know, I could work out at home, go to the studio, which is kind of like the new normal, I guess, for everybody. But I had a very nice studio in Bushwick and I had a gallery in that space. And I think the thing that surprised me the most, or what was the biggest takeaway, is the community you build and the connections you make, because it's the most organic way of networking, right? You meet, you can't help but meet the people you cross in the hallway or get into your studio. And these are the people that are going to include you into shows, they're going to curate your work, they're going to buy it, like you said. So that's really important. That's been fantastic. What are some of the artists, what do they do in your space? Are they all gravitate towards one medium, or are you all similar? What is that like?
There's definitely a similarity. I've met a lot of painters. I've met painters. I share my studio right now with two artists. One of them is mostly a photographer, printmaker, and the other one is making these sculptural paintings. So and then I make more straightforward paintings. And then I used to make installations in my studio. I don't do those anymore, but I still make installations elsewhere. So we have kind of a cool flow in our studio and our space. On my floor in the building, there are painters and a photographer that I just saw moved in. And it's mostly, then there's a bunch of folks too that I have never, like, I see their name on their doors, but I have no clue who they are, nor have I run into them. So, but it's a weird time, you know, COVID, like I stopped going to my studio in the middle of March when work shut down and it was like, everybody stay home. I was like, oh shit, I can't keep traveling and commuting. So I packed as much as I could into like two IKEA bags, brought it home, and I was like, okay, I guess I'm just gonna have a studio at home again. Rearranged the bedroom, made a huge mess, and set up like a mixed media table for myself. So I was working no longer on paintings. Now I'm like, okay, let me do more collage based mixed media drawing stuff, stuff that is just easier to manage rather than like big canvases, you know. But then I started going back to the studio in May. And slowly I started seeing people come back, and both of my studio mates have not been back to the studio since March or February. So I've been by myself, which has been amazing. Just an opportunity to like, just again, like be alone and be in my thinking and my process and developing my work. But slowly I've seen people come back to the building.
Wow.
And by this point, it's like a busy building at this point.
Wow.
Every time I go, there's just folks all over the place. But again, it's kind of like a secluded part of the South Bronx. It's really like the next across the street is a big like Fresh Direct and FedEx factory. And then it's the water. So sure. there's nowhere to like, you know, the South Bronx itself is like a very vibrant, bustling community, but I'm facing sort of the edge of it. So it's perfect. It's perfect for zero distractions, and I can just, you know, go and do my thing.
That's great. Talk to me a little bit about the difference that took place in your work when you were working small opposed to your regular practice. Did you find yourself exploring any new ideas or any new concepts, or did something come up that you weren't expecting?
Yeah, a lot came up that I wasn't expecting. So when I moved my stuff back home, I in my studio, I used to have a section dedicated to like dry media. So I used to have like this little shelf storage thing with a bunch of papers, maps. So I use a lot of maps in my work, all my collage materials, my cutting mats, my knives, like everything was there so that it wouldn't get full of paint and covered up with like all my other stuff. So then I have all my wet media on another table.
Smart.
And when I brought everything home, I was like, let me take a little bit of here and let me take a little bit of here. And I found this book. It's an atlas of maps, street maps from Jacksonville, Florida. And I had it because I brought it home from Miami where I grew up. It was in my parents' house. And I was like, oh, this is an interesting book of maps. I'll cut these up and use them someday. So I found it and I was like, oh, I haven't used this yet. But it's in a spiral, it's a spiral bound book. So it's kind of like the perfect sketchbook almost.
Oh, sure.
And so I took it home and I was like, oh, I could do drawings on these. Like, that'd be really cool. Kind of like a diary or like a daily journal type of thing. So anyway, I packed it all up, brought it home, unpacked everything. I was like, okay, maybe what I can do is do like a drawing a day on in this book. So every day just pick a map, you know, in sequence, you know, literally flipping order, and just do something to that map. So I was thinking of these as like mixed media interventions. So using graphite, charcoal, ink markers, anything but paint, essentially. And so I was really thinking more about drawing and working on a much smaller scale. These are like 8.5 by 11 almost. And it was really different. It was very intimate, right? Because I'm working on a small scale and suddenly I had to work within that little world. And it was also what the map was giving me. So it wasn't a blank canvas. It wasn't like I was working on from in my usual process where I'm really thinking about like how many grounds of gesso do I start with. That's where I begin. This time I'm thinking, okay, there's something here that I'm going to intervene, that I'm going to add to or take away from. And so that process took me a minute to get back into and to kind of think in that way. But I was having a dialogue, and I was dialoguing with the map, and I was dialoguing with what was in front of me, the colors that the map brought, the text. I don't use text in my work anymore. It was like, wow, this is interesting. So slowly thinking, like, what do I want to put onto this map? What is this conversation I'm having with the map as an artist? I'm not just doodling. I'm not just like scribbling on it. I'm bringing some intention to this. So it was really cool. And I started it as a daily thing, and I was documenting it and putting it on Instagram, and I made a highlight for it. Then after like day 12, I stopped because it just was a lot. I was like, okay, I'm not going to. Today's the day I don't do a map. You know what I mean? So I didn't want to feel guilty about it. And I was like, ah, forget it. It's fine. And I picked it up again later. That turned into doing some other bigger collage works, which was fun for a while. And then I went back into painting, and I ended up making two really large scale paintings in my bedroom. I think I just couldn't anymore. Like, I think I was like, I have to paint.
Sure. Yeah. Well, in your work, you deal with themes of borders and migration and displacement. I'm wondering if while you were addressing these themes subconsciously or head on a micro scale opposed to a macro scale, did new conversations arise? Did it become more of a technical endeavor or challenge?
I think it opened up, it definitely opened some things up for me. I also, in the midst of all of this, bought a printer. Very simple inkjet, just like a regular printer, you know, nothing fancy. And then I started printing things onto the maps. And all of a sudden I was like, oh, now we're moving into this world of image making and reproduction onto these found maps, onto my drawings that I was never doing and I never would have done before. If I was in my studio, I don't have a printer, I don't have Wi-Fi, I don't bring my computer there. I don't think that would have happened. So now I'm all of a sudden I'm playing with imagery that I've been playing with in larger scale, like the chain link fence, for instance, that pattern, or the barbed wire. Now I'm sourcing those images online, doing things to them on Photoshop, printing them on top of these maps or my drawings, and suddenly now the layering and the imagery is building up in a different way. So there's definitely, and then now I'm learning from those to apply into my larger scale paintings. So there's this really interesting, suddenly like everything opened up, you know, like all new things opened up for me. So that was really cool. And just thinking about reproduction too, like thinking about printmaking. I mean, I love printmaking, and I've always found a way to like sneak a print in somewhere. Since I was young, I've loved printmaking, and I started doing these some like linoleum cuts, and then I was reproducing those on the computer. So I was printing on top of my prints to just, you know, make more, essentially. So I have these ideas now for installations that I want to make using printed reproductions of my works. Yeah, so it's like all these new things are opening up for me.
Let me ask you, I kind of want to go back to something you said a second ago that kind of jarred me a little bit. So you said you don't have any Wi-Fi in your studio. Is that a choice, or the circumstance?
Is that a choice, or are you just broke? That's a choice. Yeah, okay.
So the building does have.
No, the building does not have internet.
So that's
my studio did not come with Wi-Fi. Yeah. I think like somebody on our floor has, and you can just join theirs and pay them. And when we were first moved into the studio, me and my studio mate, we were going to do that. And then we were like, she has Optimum. So we logged onto her Optimum account, and then it was super, super slow. And we had a computer, we had a desktop that we were sharing. And, after we would use it like for Spotify, it was like not, we were barely doing any computer work because we both had desk jobs. And so we would do any of our like studio based computer work during work and then go to the studio to make stuff. So in 2020, I took the computer home and we just, it was like, okay, no more computer. It's taking up space. It's dead space. The internet sucks. So let's just forget it. And honestly, you could do everything on your phone. Like, at some point, I just started doing all my Zoom meetings from my phone for work, or like if I was doing webinars or if I was taking a class, I would just get on my phone and sit in my studio. I didn't need my laptop or the Wi-Fi. And to be honest with you, the phone is enough of a distraction as it is.
Sure.
You know, the last thing I need is another computer in my space.
Absolutely. Yeah. It kind of like reminds me of the progression of things, right? So I live in Williamsburg after the artist left, right? So now it's just a bunch of condos and fancy buildings and super expensive cafes, not a lot of people of color. I had a studio in Bushwick, which, you know, which if I'm sure you're familiar with, there's tons of galleries, tons of studio spaces. And we're kind of fed this idea, oh, it's New York, this is where the artists are. And it looks like a third world country, like graffiti everywhere. It's dirty, it's gross. Yeah. But there's a white wall gallery here, you know, selling paintings for $10,000 a pop. And you think it's normal. But just in retrospect, thinking like, oh shit, like we put up with so much, you know? Mm-hmm. And first comes, you know, the artist, then comes the gays to buy and to live, and then come the yuppies or whatever you call them. But it's so interesting to see these cycles, you know, happening over and over. And I know.
They're horrible.
Well, they're interesting. I think, you know, you're in the ground level and you really have an opportunity to kind of like set roots and what would that look like, you know, and who comes in and who stays.
I'm very protective of my space out there. Like there are a lot of people who are fighting gentrification from coming into the South Bronx the way that Brooklyn has experienced it or Harlem, because you know Harlem had a ton of artist studios. I mean it was an incredible mecca for Black art, and even in the it still is, but not the same way.
Yeah.
Now you've got multi-million dollar apartments in the middle of central Harlem, you know, and you have galleries popping up in Harlem, and you have Whole Foods, and you have, you know, so the whole scene is changing. But in the South Bronx, there's a lot of people who've been fighting to keep the South Bronx in the hands of the people who live there in the community. And I think it's the right way to go. I think there are some really cool galleries and nonprofit spaces and like home run spaces that cultivate that sense of community in a really specific way.
Yeah.
And that uplift people from the Bronx. You know, it's not just like a bunch of people want to, and the thing is, this is what's happening, is a bunch of people are leaving grad school. right? And they're all moving to the Bronx because that's where the cheap studios are now. And so now you've got, you know, you're rubbing shoulders with a bunch of recent MFA grads who have nothing to do with the Bronx, don't know anything about it, don't identify with its racial demographics, and are going to love to see another Starbucks on the corner or a new cafe or another white gallery space. And that's the cycle that we have to fight to stop. So I'm extremely protective of the South Bronx. I don't invite everyone to my studio. I'm very selective about who I let in my space. I'm very selective about what information I share with people, like how much I pay for rent or who my landlord is or who I share my studio with. Like I don't want people to, I'm trying to figure out all of the ways that I can embed myself in the South Bronx in a way that amplifies the people who are there now, the artists who have been there now, the businesses that have been there now. I only support local when I'm there. So it's a lot, you know, it's kind of crazy, but
yeah, it's wild. I remember a few years back, there was this whole uproar about the Piano District and how they were trying make that happen. And then some crazy gallery had a Bronx themed party I mean, talk about
that. A bunch of celebrities were part of. I mean, it's really gross, you know. The thing is, it's a waterfront, so it's just across from Astoria and the Upper East Side, and it's a beautiful piece of land that belongs to the people who have been there for generations. So yeah, it's nuts. But you know what, there's a lot of artists who are very much in tune with defending the Bronx, and there's a lot of ways to get involved and a lot of people to support, a lot of organizations to support, and a lot of movement, a lot of groundwork happening to keep developers and real estate out. And that's really, you know, it starts there. It starts with the government. It starts with who has permits and permission to build.
Yeah. I'm always wondering, you know, I don't think it's enough to see brown or black owned galleries, because if it doesn't matter who's doing it, but if you're operating in the same systems, doing the same things that are problematic to begin with, like separating the artist from the community or making it inaccessible to people, to culture, then you're doing the same thing. It doesn't matter if you're brown or if you're black, but if you're the gallery owner operating in the same systems, it makes no sense.
Well, and a gallery too, like galleries don't all have to do the same thing.
Exactly.
Like if you want to open a gallery that is a for-profit business, you're going to do that as any business in a place where your customers exist.
Right.
So why would you open a high-end, you know, art gallery in a low-income neighborhood?
Exactly.
That doesn't make sense. What you're doing is actually just trying to benefit off of cultural capital and the coolness of, you know, lower-income people. So go open your gallery where your clients live, where you can make business, and show the artists you want to show. If what you want to do is show black and brown people, then do that. But don't, you don't have to take up space in those communities. Now, if you're a gallery that's nonprofit and your goal is to amplify community and nurture that and nurture emerging talent, let's say, then do so and do it in an ethical way. Who is part of your community board? Who runs your space? Who is the front and the back of your space?
Yeah, totally.
You know, so there's, I think galleries can open wherever they want. You know, I think that there's value to them, but it's really about what is the intention behind the spaces that we're taking up, you know?
Are you an artist or want to be, but can use a guide, a cheerleader, and a coach? I'm excited to announce that I'm now officially coaching an artist. Let's work together on a project-based, result-driven outline to get you into a state of prolific flow. Because artists like us don't seek validation. We create our own opportunities to shine. Go to prolificflow.com and drop me a line. Now is our time. Let's work together.
So talk to me a little bit about your work. What was your first experience in art? How did that happen?
I was 4 years old. my earliest memory of being alive, like a human, a conscious human being, is drawing on a little, you know, those, remember those little Etch-a-Sketch? It's the one that had the two little wheels and you would turn it left and right.
Sure.
And go up, down, sideways. That was my first memory. And it was Christmas. I got one of those for Christmas. And that was, you know, that. And the one that has the magnet strip where you would draw and then swipe it clean. And I used to be obsessed with Ursula from The Little Mermaid.
Oh my God. Of course.
I used to draw. That was like my, I used to draw that. And then when I was very, very little, I used to draw nativity scenes. And I know, weird, right? And
I thought you were going to say nativity scenes with Ursula. That would be amazing.
No. I don't think I ever combined my genres. It was like Ursula, nativity scenes, and horses. And we had horses when we lived in Ecuador. And I used to love drawing those three. Those were like my three go-tos.
Wow.
But I grew up, I know, I grew up my whole life making art. And when I moved to Miami, when my family moved to Miami, my second grade art teacher, Darla Kosky, whom I adore, and she saw something in me and had me apply to a magnet art school in Miami for third grade, which is the earliest you can get into. You have to audition for. So I started third grade in a magnet art program, public school, but like a specialized arts elementary school. And then I did middle school, and then I went to high school, and then art college. So it's just, it's my whole life.
I love Darla. Wow, that's fantastic. That's amazing. Now, yes. Every time I think of Miami, I think of, like, it's the capital of Latin America, right? Mm-hmm. Can you tell me a little bit about what that was for you like growing up in Miami? Because, you know, there's a sexiness that is attributed to Miami. But for me personally, yeah, I see it as, wow, the Latinos who are from Miami seem super empowered. And it comes from this like weird, like, yeah, we know we got it because we got it.
Yeah.
Opposed to the angry Latino in New York, yeah, or like the the Hollywood Latino in LA.
Yeah. It's definitely, yeah, right. There's definitely these archetypes. I didn't know how to process Miami until I left Miami.
Yeah, that makes sense.
Like my experience of Miami not living there anymore is very different from the one that I had growing up there, because, you know, you grew up in a space, first of all, I'm 31 now, when I was growing up, and I left Miami when I was 18, I went to college in New York. So technically I lived there from when I was 5 to when I was 18. And when I was a teen, and when you're younger than a teen, you don't have the language back then to talk about things like, you know, the identity, the way that we talk about identity now, and the way that we talk about politics now, the way that young people do, did not exist when I was that young.
Right.
It I don't know where it was. If it did, it wasn't where I was.
Sure.
It wasn't in my community. So there was no awareness of the dynamics beyond like, oh, what country are you from? Oh, I'm from Ecuador. You're from Venezuela. Cool. That's it. End of story. There is no more discussion. Everybody is Latino in some way. And if you're not, if you're white American or black American, if you're black in Miami, you're probably from the Caribbean. If you're not, you're an exception. And if you are white American in Miami, you're either Jewish or somehow you wound up there. And then there's always a question of why are you here? But when we were younger, and then there's a huge Asian community as well. And when I was growing up, I was in extremely diverse neighborhoods, schools, classrooms, everything. Everything was hugely multicultural, multi-ethnic. It was never not normal. There were no minorities in that sense. Most of my growing up, most of the schools that I went to were majority black. And then Latino. So it was a really awesome way to grow up. It was beautiful. And everybody spoke Spanish. If you were walking around Miami, wherever, whatever neighborhood you were in, people were going to speak to you in Spanish. So I grew up speaking Spanish in my house. I grew up speaking Spanish when I went out to the store or whatever. And, you know, we always knew, like, this neighborhood is primarily this. This neighborhood is primarily that. And it never felt like being Latino in Miami was a challenge or weird or othered.
Sure.
And it wasn't until I moved to New York when I went to Purchase College, which is it's near White Plains, New York. So it's just slightly outside the city. But let me tell you, it's out enough in right next to Greenwich, Connecticut, and sort of Westchester, you know, one of the richest zip codes in the country, tucked away in the woods. It was a huge culture shock for me. Huge, huge culture shock. It was the first time anybody said, "I love your accent," to me. I was like, "What?" I had a moment. I was like, "What? I have an accent? What do you mean? Say more. I love accents." No, I was like, "What the fuck are you talking about? I don't have an accent." They're like, "Yeah, you do." I'm like, "Wow, that's so rude." And
I love that. I mean, that's horrible, but that's really funny.
Yeah, it was a huge adjustment. My first year of college sucked.
Well,
I had weird groups of friends. Yeah,
you said you were drawing on these maps of Jacksonville, but do you see Miami in your work?
No. Yes and no.
How?
Yes and no. I think Miami is just home. There's nothing really outlining Miami for me besides it's my home. It's where my parents are. It's where I grew up. It's where I used to go to church. It's where I went to high school. It's where I, you know, it's where I started to drive. It's where I, you know, go to the beach, play volleyball. Like, it's not really anything else besides that space for me. I don't have a sort of critical approach to it in my work. Jacksonville was specific because the reason my family moved to Jacksonville when I was 18, when I had left to college, I think around that time my family moved and lived in Jacksonville for 5 years or so, because in 2008, our house in Miami was foreclosed on and the market crashed. So we had to move, and that was the place where my dad found work. So that is the only reason we left Miami. Thankfully, my parents are back in South Florida now, and my brother bought a house there. So I'm really, really glad to be near my family again. I have some cousins there, and I go as much as I can. But for me, that's why Jacksonville is such a specific plays such a specific role in my work and thinking about displacement and dislocation. But Miami is – it's, you know, that's where I grew up. And I was born in Ecuador. I was born in Quito, but – it's not my home, you know. It's definitely not my home, and it's not. People ask me where I'm from. I say I'm from Miami first. I say I was born in Ecuador, but I'm from Miami, because that's the truth.
Yeah, and then do you get that? But where are you really from?
I just say I'm from Miami, but I was born in Ecuador. And then sometimes I'll be like, "Oh, what city or what part of Ecuador?" And I'm always surprised that people know anything about it. So I'm like, Quito, and they're like, "Oh, nice. I'm, you know, whatever.
So tell me, when you make your work, who is it for? Who's the audience?
It's always for me. It's always for me. I think that there's always an audience. I think that my work, there's many layers to my work, and there's many ways of approaching my work. And I think that you can read my work in any number of ways. I think that there's meaning in ways that I'd have never even come across yet. So I know that my work can be appreciated, and it is. It's appreciated by many, many different types of people. And I think that as long as I'm making work that I connect to, there are going to be people who connect to it and connect to me. And I love that my work can cross borders. I love that my work can supersede these sort of like boxes that sometimes artists are put into. You know, my work is not just like hashtag immigrant art or hashtag Latinx art or whatever. It's also abstract. It's also mixed media. It's also, you know, using maps and collage and installations and immersive experiences. And
well, it's very subtle. I found your use of the chain link fence really graceful, I want to say. There's something really beautiful about it and how you were able to manipulate that constantly, right? Because that's part of your visual vocabulary.
Yeah.
How did you arrive at that?
Yeah, the chain link fence.
It's painful. It's a weird, it's a really painful thing to look at. But the way that you present it, it takes it beyond the pain.
Yeah, and it's, let me tell you, it's painful to like draw it and paint it. It's very, it slows me down as an artist. It goes against my nature, which is a more active, abstract gesture. But the chain link fence, so I have been questioning borders and working with this idea of borders and the hybrid identity in my work for many, many years, since college, before college even. And I stopped sort of exploring physical borders, imagery of physical borders or the wall for a number of years. And I started using text. I started using pattern. I was looking at like textile designs from Ecuador and trying to make some connections. And I was cutting a lot into my work, and I was working on paper and canvas, very mixed. I've always been very mixed media. The cutting created a fence effect, because now you're looking through the painting or the piece, right? And I was always really interested in that. And I've created big installations where you're looking through a wall that is a painting, and you're looking through the text that I cut out. And so I've always liked that idea. I've always also been really amused by the fact that the frontera, or the border at the Mexico and U.S. border, is a fence. And for the majority, it's just a stupid fence. So I've always been amused at that idea. And the chain link fence became a way to explore that again. And it gave me the ability to sort of like see through it. And so suddenly I could think about the fence conceptually as what's on both sides, what lies on both sides of a border, and this idea that it's just not a permanent fixture, that a fence can be broken, and that a fence can be, that is weak, to be honest, or self-destructive, right? Like it will decompose over time. And it also became more recently like a fishing net. Hmm. And so the pattern of the fence and the through the gesture of painting it became a net, like for fishing. And I realized all of the connections then that I was making between the water, the land, the sky, the celestial. Those are really important to me. And the forms that you see in my work come from those shapes. So they look like water. They look like waves. They also look like clouds. They also might look like a shooting star, or they look like islands, you know, and they represent all of that. They represent the things that are not constant or fixed in the world. And for me, that's an immigrant. And so in many ways, the fence and the fishing net become symbols of the borders that are placed on us, or that we place on ourselves, but also the way that we can trespass them, and the way that we can defeat them, or in the way that they're really impermanent in and of themselves. So they become this beautiful pattern. They also represent this horrible, you know, political structure, history, but very in a very delicate way.
Yeah, very delicate. I love that you kind of question its strength, right? Because it's literally a chain link fence from Home Depot or something. And you almost turn it into lace, which is kind of beautiful. Yeah. So that's nice. Yeah. I really love your work. To close, I'm just wondering, what advice do you have for someone who's just getting their studio practice going? What makes a really good studio practice, in your opinion?
Discipline. I think you have to show up. You have to commit to showing up, and that's it. You know, you don't have to commit to anything working or anything coming true or success in whatever way we've been taught to think of success. You just have to show up to your studio.
Yeah.
That's it. Just go, just show up, just make the work. Everything comes after that. Nothing can happen if you don't have work made. You know what I mean? You can have all the connections in the world. You can have all the money in the world. You can blah, blah, blah. If the work is not there, it's just not going to happen. So I think the first, you know, that's, if nothing else, just show up to your studio and make something. And the beautiful thing about a studio is that it doesn't ever have to leave your studio if you don't want it. You can throw it away. I can't tell you how many times I've painted over my paintings over and over and over and over. Or just straight up throwing them away or, you know, whatever. But you can, your studio is your, you know, your studio, your rules, and it's your world. It should be your sanctuary. It is for me, at least.
Yeah.
It's your space to be your fullest self and to make all the mistakes you want to, but also the place to find it, to find yourself, to find your voice. And none of it happens if you don't show up. So just get your ass to your studio.
I love that. Francisco, thank you so much for taking some time and talking to me about studio in the Bronx. And I love your work. I hope to see more of it.
Thank you.
Cheers.
Thank you so much. Bye.
Want to share your thoughts on the conversation? Reach out on Instagram at StuConPodcast or visit the website studioconfessions.com. Follow me and check out my work at Art Engineer. Please leave a review on whichever platform you're listening on. It goes a long way. Thanks for listening. If you heard anything that moved you, please share it. You are the spark that can ignite 1,000 flames. I am Luis Martin, the Art Engineer, sharing with you what moves me.